Now more of the Wild About Pets radio show on TalkZone.com. Once again, here's Susan Frank.
You're listening to the Wild About Pets radio show, and we're talking with Lee Hansen, and we're talking today about animals in our backyards that you might not know about. Our phone lines are also open if you'd like to join our conversation and ask our guest a question. And the phone line number is 888-463-6748. I'll repeat that. That's 888-463-6748, and we are live, and today is December 5th. Lee, we were talking about opossums, and you said there was something about the babies that you wanted to mention to us. What is that?
I just think it's fascinating that I mentioned the marsupial, and they have this pouch. When the babies are born, they're no larger than a navy bean, maybe a half an inch in length, and they're naked. They can't see, they can't hear, they do have an opening for a mouth. And they basically have to find on their own their way up to the pouch, this marsupial pouch. And it's about a 3-inch journey. And oftentimes the mom will sort of lick a path in preparation for this. But my gosh, what an incredible journey they have to make. Once they get in the pouch, they have to find a teat, a nipple that they can attach to get their nourishment. And here's another catch. There's only 13 nipples in the pouch, and oftentimes there are 16, 18, or 20 young. So they often don't make it, and even if they make it to the pouch, don't make it beyond that.
The idea then is it's the stronger little babies that are going to, you know, get to one of those nipples that are the ones that are really meant to survive.
And the lucky.
Yes, and the lucky ones.
So hence, have some love for opossums.
All right, we'll keep that in mind. There's another type of a bird, a hawk, that I think is not commonly seen. Let's look at that. What is this bird that we're going to talk about next?
Well, we get a lot of calls at the Nature Center about a bird that was in my backyard, and I got to watch it out the window, folks will say. And typically it's related to also, and I was feeding my birds, you know, bird feeder, filling my bird feeder, whatever, and this bird's been hanging out watching that bird feeder, and sure enough, it flew down and picked off one of the birds, a sparrow, something else. A lot of people seeing this activity. These are Cooper's hawks, more than likely. And Cooper's hawks, while they were on the decline after the use of DDT, once DDT was banned, many of our nesting birds of prey, such as this, did increase. And we are seeing an increase in our area. This is the Chicagoland area in particular, and other places, of Cooper's hawks.
Sometimes one, as they're driving across the country, is used to looking up on the telephone pole lines and seeing some birds. Or I know some people have gotten used to recognizing hawks. Where might one spot Cooper's hawks, and how could we really tell if we're looking at a Cooper's hawk? So what I'm asking, is there any easy way to identify this bird?
Distinguishing characteristics, what it looks like in flight. Yes, you do have to be a good observer. It's really tough when somebody calls and says, there was this gray bird in the backyard. try to get as many details. Size is important. What was it doing and where was it? Now, these are birds, and also when it was in flight, what was the shape of the wings, the tail, what distinguishing characteristics, markings, things like that. Cooper's hawks, gosh, there's a lot of different distinguishing characteristics, but first of all, you're going to find them mostly in areas of trees and shrubs. So they're probably not going to be the one that's sitting on a telephone pole.
Okay.
They are designed for flying through the trees and the forests and, well, going after birds. Their primary source of food is birds. They will eat other animals as well. They have beautiful orange and or yellow eyes. They have beautiful bright yellow legs and great markings on them, shorter rounded wings and long narrow tails, not pointy tails, but long narrow tails. And the bottom, if you're looking at it from underneath and even on the top, the tail has bars on it. And the very last bar is a white bar. So that's another good distinguishing characteristic. The breast may have different bars and markings and streaks on it, too, depending on the age of the bird.
I was interested that the juvenile's eyes are yellow, and then when they become adults, they turn red.
Wouldn't that be cool if we could, too?
I don't know if I'd want yellow and red eyes. Of course, no. We can get contacts.
That's true.
So there's a photograph number 14 for those of you who can see the photos while we're listening to the show. And by the way, if this is not something you can do right now, you can always look at the photographs later, because both the radio program and these photographs are archived, and you can easily get to them from my website, which is wildaboutpets.net. There's a picture of a hornet's nest in a tree, and then, of course, there's another picture of one of these attached to a house. And no doubt a lot of people have seen these here. And what is unusual, what would you want to tell people about this particular hornet and its name, Lee?
All righty. Bald-faced hornet, we don't even usually see it during the summer. It actually truly is more related to a yellow jacket wasp. And that's a whole other story. Yellow jacket wasps are the one that bug you in the at the picnics, mm-hmm. and go after your food and seem to be provoked by absolutely nothing. I'm not terribly fond of them. Bald-faced hornets, I am very fond of. They're very docile. They aren't provoked easily, and you never even know they're there until the leaves fall in our area on the deciduous trees, and all of a sudden people say, "What is this huge gray football-like mass hanging in the tree in my front yard?" And so often people are astounded by the fact that they had a yellow or a bald-faced hornet nest right in their yard.
So you're saying that the universal fear that people have of anything that resembles a bee or a wasp or a hornet is misplaced when it comes to this particular.
Sure. Now, if it was right above the front door of your house that they determined to make their nest, then you probably are going to need to remove it and do so with a lot of good advice and care and maybe a professional, because anything is going to defend its home. Mm. And if you get within about 3 feet of a bald-faced hornet's nest, it will be very protective. Fascinating creatures. They go out and chew up wood and mix it with saliva and produce this papery substance that they create their honeycomb. It's like a comb inside, many different tiers of combs, but a really cool nest. And we see them again in the fall. We very seldom see the critter itself again because it's not very, very present. But in the fall, the nests are often shredded. The raccoons will go up there. There are very few critters left in them, maybe a couple larvae. And they don't usually reuse them from year to year. So you don't even need to really worry about taking it down. It'll be taken down by the weather and the raccoons. And it's only the queen that survives the winter, and she's somewhere else right now.
Well, where would she be during the winter?
I was going to say something exotic like Barbados or something. No, actually, she's in the ground. So she's overwintering in the ground, maybe under a log, maybe in a barn, maybe in a shed, somewhere where she can get enough protection to survive through the winter.
Is this something that a child digging around in the snow or playing in the snow, could they dig up the queen?
That queen is not going to be able to do anything about it. If they did, she's so cold. So again, a pretty docile creature, not really a threat.
Okay, here's another small little creature. Now, a lot of people are very familiar with, you know, the mice that, you know, their children have as pets, or the mice that come into their homes. And I think everyone kind of think all mice are the same. And people either are fond of them, you know, because they're so cute, but often don't want them living with them. What about this other type of small rodent that is prevalent in the Midwest that's not the house mouse?
Yep. And there's a lot of them out there. And again, it's a creature we seldom see. It's known as a vole. That's V as in Victor, O-L-E. There are three different kinds of voles we might find in our area: prairie, meadow, and woodland, or woods vole. They have very similar habits to a mouse and some different habits as well. They tend to be a little bit more crepuscular, active in dawn and dusk, or nighttime, can be active during the daytime as well. And they are eating seeds, they're eating roots, they're eating bulbs, they're eating grasses and sedges. And I do see you have a picture of a coyote here, and I think that's very mm-hmm. poignant, because you had a guest on several weeks ago, Dr. Stan Garrett.
Yes.
And in his study, when his grad student had the delightful task of taking apart all the scat, or the poop, of the coyotes and finding out what they eat, they determined their primary food source in the Chicagoland area is rodents. And of the rodents, voles were number one. So we know they're here.
And I'm so glad you mentioned that, because one of the things that I'd wanted to bring out in the show with Dr. Garrett was what the coyotes really eat the most of, you know, because there's so many people in the large cities that are so worried about their cats and dogs. And we spoke about that, and that sometimes coyotes will, you know, eat a cat. But mostly their diet is comprised of the small rodents, and it's a benefit that coyotes are here eating and controlling that rodent population.
Yeah. In fact, in his study, in one area where they eliminated the coyotes that were at a particular golf course, they saw an increase in the rodent population. So there's a direct correlation there. Yeah, in his particular study, in our area, their primary food source, rodents and deer. And those are two things we have a lot of around here. The vole is, again, a very cool creature. It does dig a series of underground burrows that are connected tunnels. It can be a kind of social creature. I am told that recently my mother, in fact, saw a colony where they were all popping their heads out of various holes and then going back in. They also have above ground tunnels, and they use that tunnel network, and depending on which vole it is, it could be through grasses, so kind of this tunnel network through grasses, or under leaves if they're in a woodland.
Oh, and they are cute animals, aren't they?
They are.
Do voles try and get into people's homes for warmth?
I have never heard of that. Not like you hear about the mice coming into garages and things like that. I have never heard a report. That's not to say it's not true, but I've never heard of voles entering people's homes or even their dwellings.
And they're more shy creatures. So if someone sees a mouse, they're most likely not seeing a vole, or could they be seeing one?
Not so much that, because again, you know, we've had plenty of sightings ourselves if we know where to look and what we're looking at. The vole is a more stout creature. It's a little bit rounder than a mouse would be. Mouse is a little more sleek and has shorter ears, even though it does have external ears. Its tail is only about a third of its body length instead of as long as a mouse's tail. So those are good characteristics to help distinguish the two.
So basically they're harmless little animals, and they're not trying to dig into people's homes, and they're going about their lives.
Digging into their gardens and eating their bulbs and tubers.
Oh,
and in the wintertime, tunneling through the snow and grasses and chewing some of the vegetation. So that's where they get a bad rap. But oftentimes we don't even know they're there.
All right. Let's see. Is there anything more that we want to talk about with the coyotes at this point?
Just that I think they're a fascinating creature, and they do contribute also to helping us with the population control of the deer. Seldom do they take down adult deer, but they are helping with the deer population by going for the fawns, which, you know, maybe sounds sad, but it certainly is contributing to helping in that ecological balance. They are also helping with the control of Canada geese, which, as many people know, have responded very well to our urban settings, as the white-tailed deer have. And they seldom will take, you know, be able to kill an adult goose, but they raid their nests quite easily and readily, and will take the eggs back to the kids.
I hear often residents of either apartment complexes or the places with the ponds are finding that the Canadian geese, even though they might like the animal, their droppings have become a real issue. And a lot of people are worried and want something done about the geese. And so I love the fact, Lee, that you're bringing up, well, one of the things, the natural things that is being done about it is by having this population of coyotes. So everyone, this is one of those benefits of having, you know, this predator here in our area. And I do encourage anyone to listen to that show on coyotes. I think it was called Wild Coyotes in the City, and also to refer to the study, the Cook County Coyote Project that Dr. Garrett did write, if you're interested more, because as Lee mentioned, we did do a show on that. And yes, I like coyotes also, and they have great benefit to us in this area.
Can I mention one other thing in terms of how we should interact if we do sight one?
Please do.
And this, again, comes from Dr. Garrett's studies as well. We tend to want to observe the creature because we're in awe of seeing it, most of us, if we're not fearful of it. But what we should really be doing is not habituate them to humans again, and we should wave our arms, yell, and basically try to scare it so that it doesn't become too familiar and comfortable with people. We want them to continue to be afraid of us so that they don't, you know, provide problems or present problems to us. And you don't want to feed them. Please don't, you know, put out food, cat food, dog food that they might be going after. You don't want to deliberately feed the coyotes. and definitely discourage their presence in our human area just by your actions.
Now, if I go out and I start yelling at a coyote and waving, is it possible that they're going to get angry and become aggressive and come after me if I do that?
Not in our area. In the Cook County area, we have not seen that response at all. If we're talking about this population of coyotes in the, metropolitan urban area of Chicago, no, they will hopefully respond by turning tail and running away. And you don't want to run away yourself, and nor would I suggest you run after it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Sure, just try and chase it away, mm-hmm. And that is a good tip, a very good tip. We have some photographs of our white-tailed deer, since you kind of mentioned deer.
Mm-hmm.
And we have, a male deer, the buck, and we've got some does. And you said that coyotes do kind of help control the population. But what's one of the wonderful things about deer now? These are fairly common animals that we see, but is there something that maybe is a little less known about deer that you could share with us?
Well, they weren't common a while ago. They were always present in the Illinois area. They were always present in the Midwest. But due to overhunting, they were almost extirpated, almost eradicated from the state. And so they were reintroduced in the 1900s, and efforts were made to rebuild their population. And, oh, have they been successful. So we have more deer now than we have ever had historically in this part of the country. Fascinating creatures. They can jump up to 8 feet and probably higher. They can leap 30 feet distance. They're beautiful and graceful. The whole topic of how they're impacting our native ecosystems is another story.
Mm-hmm. Yes, one that maybe we'll discuss at some point. It's time to take another short break. Again, stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.